It is Monday, March the 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, North Korea dominating U.S.-Chinese talks in Beijing.
North Korea has shown the world that its nuclear weapons and missile capabilities have advanced dramatically over the past few years. So as we want to patronize and laugh at North Korea, I think North Korea, for now, the party getting the last laugh.
Also ahead, nominee to be the next U.S. High Court Justice goes before a confirmation hearing, plus remembering a renowned American musician. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and Chinese President Xi Jinping spent a brief time together over the weekend as Mr. Tillerson concluded his first Asia visit with stops in Japan and South Korea before going to Beijing. He said the U.S. is looking forward to building on the relationship between President Trump and Mr. Xi that began last month.
President Trump places a very high value on the communications that have already occurred between yourself and President Trump, most particularly the very lengthy telephone conversation where there were very good exchanges to improve the understanding of China's view of the relationship with the United States and President Trump's view as well.
President Xi reiterated comments from that phone conversation with President Trump when the two leaders agreed to further U.S.-China cooperation. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Asia scholar Sunyun Lee of Tufts University if anything really concrete came out of the meeting between Secretary Tillerson and Mr. Xi.
Probably not. This is the first high-level meeting between the new Trump administration and the Chinese leadership. The U.S. Secretary of State passed through Japan and South Korea, where he struck a much more hardline stance. In Japan, he said, the past 20 years of nuclear diplomacy vis-a-vis North Korea has failed, meaning the U.S. is now poised to try something much more aggressive, something totally different. And then on his stopover in South Korea, Mr. Tillerson said that all options are on the table, including military strike, the use of military force. Now, of course, all options are on the table in principle, but for the U.S. Secretary of State to say so on his visit to South Korea, that is a difference, big difference between saying it and not saying it. So whether there is any substance behind that threat or it's just mere bluster remains to be seen, but the tone was quite serious that the U.S. is really bent on pressuring North Korea and even going after Chinese banks, entities that may facilitate North Korea's weapons development. And then he goes to China. Of course, it makes sense not to growl, frown, not to exchange epithets with your host. And I think the Chinese and the American delegate envoy struck the right tone, not broaching, at least in public before the press, sensitive issues like THAAD deployment in South Korea, the issue of Taiwan, or even the issue of sanctioning Chinese entities by the U.S. So that was the right tone struck, but whether there was any real serious exchange or views on issues of substance like that and Taiwan, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were.
Mr. Xi is supposed to meet next month with President Trump. Will North Korea be the top issue between those or other issues?
It will be among the top, of course, as it always is. Now, the Chinese position on the North Korean nuclear issue has been constant. It's been the same over the past quarter century. The Chinese have a mantra. They say, please don't get excited. Oh, God, no war. Please, please, patience, dialogue, calm down, peace and stability. That's the central message. And sometimes that message comes across as a platitude because North Korea's nuclear and missile threat is clearly growing. I think the real change that I detect in Washington, and even just looking at the Secretary of State's visit to East Asia just now over the past few days, is that in the new Trump administration, there is, I think, a new resolve to address the North Korea issue by going after North Korea's illicit activities, blocking, designating North Korean entities that engage in illicit activities like proliferation, money laundering, human rights violations even, and censorship, and also penalizing going after North Korea's Chinese partners. There is a congressional hearing in 2 days, and all three witnesses are ardent advocates of more sanctions against North Korea and also against China. So I think the United States belatedly, after 25 years of procrastination and half measures, feels that that era of baffling, soothing expedience is now over, and in its place, we have entered a period of consequences. And I'm stealing lines from Winston Churchill here, but I think the U.S. really feels that this is no joke anymore. We have to face the truth. The North Korean nuclear threat is right now, here and present, quite imminent.
Sung Yoon Lee, China recently cut off coal imports from North Korea. Do you think China feels that sense of turn?
Absolutely not. The Chinese have taken measures, I would say even token measures, over the past 2 decades. Whenever North Korea conducts a nuclear test or long-range missile test, China has some face to lose. China is not pleased by that. But always, China has gone back to increasing trade and aid with North Korea, even after signing on to various UN Security Council resolutions purportedly penalizing North Korea. So what China has done in recent weeks, cutting off all coal import from North Korea for the rest of the year, it seems like China is now very serious to put some pressure on North Korea. But until we see that happen, that is, this ban lasting throughout 2017, I would not place a great deal of importance on this latest gesture by China.
North Korea conducted a test of its new high-thrust engine at its Tongchang-ri rocket launch station during the Tillerson visit, Pyongyang's official media calling it a new birth of its rocket industry. What is your take on that?
It could be bluster, it could be exaggeration, and North Korea is known for that as well. But it could be real. North Korea is known for that as well. That is, North Korea has shown the world that its nuclear weapons and missile capabilities have advanced dramatically over the past few years. So as we want to patronize and laugh at North Korea, I think North Korea, for now, is the party getting the last laugh.
Sung Yoon Lee is a scholar of Korean and East Asian studies and a specialist on North Korea at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He was speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. White House officials will be closely watching hearings on Capitol Hill this week as President Trump's nominee for the High Court begins confirmation testimony in the Senate, and members of the House of Representatives hear from the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, James Comey, on what, if anything, Russia may have been involved in with concerning last November's presidential election. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman previews this very busy week on Capitol Hill with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
Jim, this has already been an incredibly busy year on Capitol Hill, but the coming days, this coming week, could be the busiest yet. Not only might we get some answers from the FBI Director James Comey, who will be testifying in just a few hours later on this morning, before a House panel, we also have the beginnings of the Neil Gorsuch confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court. So that'll be on the Senate side while Director Comey is testifying on the House side. If you're a poor Capitol Hill reporter, you literally do not know which way to turn your head.
Wow. This is when you hope that you have a few colleagues to help you out on the Hill. This has a lot of implications in many different areas, especially for the White House, which has pushed for its nominee to the Supreme Court and wants to see that go through. It also raises a lot of questions about the White House, which we hope that James Comey can shed light on.
Jim, when it comes to Neil Gorsuch, I am not seeing the kind of blanket, hardened opposition to this man from Democrats that would need to materialize for him to be defeated. Now, I'm not saying that that may not yet come. And obviously, there are many people who are waiting to see what the man has to say during his confirmation hearings. He will be grilled for hours and hours and hours on multiple days. So there will be many opportunities for him to have a slip of the tongue or to perhaps be more honest than one should in such a situation. But right now, I am not seeing the kind of dogged, unified opposition to him that would have to materialize if Democrats were to, in fact, filibuster him. And the Supreme Court is one of the few remaining areas in terms of nominees where anyone can be filibustered anymore. If you are on the president's team, that is the happy news, that so far the Supreme Court pick appears to be going about as well as one could hope in a Senate chamber that is divided 52-48 Republican to Democrat, where Republicans have a very slim majority indeed. The news is much more dicey when it comes to questions about what Russia may have done and any sort of contact that may have existed between Russia and various officials, people within Donald Trump's inner circle. And of course, the president himself made the whole matter exponentially worse when he accused former President Barack Obama of ordering wiretaps on Trump Tower. Jim, I suppose that the person least envied in Washington is going to be FBI Director James Comey. There are things that he will be willing to say in an open committee that will be broadcast live on cable television and where the most juicy sound bites are going to be appearing on the evening news for all Americans to watch. There's a difference between what he's going to be willing to say in open committee versus what he might say in a closed hearing. But as anyone who knows Washington knows, eventually, whatever he says in that closed hearing may well come to light. Mm-hmm. It may not be right away, but at some point, more than likely, someone is likely to blab, and we are likely to get a fairly decent picture of what the FBI knows, doesn't know, thinks it knows, believes it has yet to find out.
We always get a fairly decent picture of what's going on each and every week with our VOA Senate correspondent, Michael Bowman. Michael, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
You know, as we just heard from Michael Bowman, Neil Gorsuch, a federal appellate judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit, has been nominated by President Trump to fill the seat vacated a year ago by High Court Justice Antonin Scalia when he died. VOA's Lori London speaks with George Mason University law professor Jamil Jaffer, who clerked for Judge Gorsuch and who will testify on his behalf this week before a Senate confirmation hearing. Lori asked Jaffer about what kind of Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch might be if he's confirmed.
He's certainly, you know, conservative, but I'd say he's in the mainstream of conservative. You know, he's not a fire breather in the sense that he's not going to have, you know, very sharp-edged, sharp-tongued opinions. He also believes strongly in judicial independence. So, you know, he's a believer in that judges, when they put that robe on, they take their politics off. And so, you know, he doesn't believe in judges being politicians in robes. I think he views the craft of judging as looking at the law as Congress passed it, the Constitution as our framers wrote it, and applying that law, whether it's the Constitution or the statute or both, to a given case based on the arguments made by the parties and trying to figure out what the right outcome is. You know, he said at his acceptance speech at the White House that, you know, a judge who likes the outcome in every case he decides is probably not a very good judge. He really takes that to heart. You know, I think he really meant that. You know, the other thing that you need to know about Neil Gorsuch is when you saw him up there on that stage accepting the nomination of the president, you'll see him this next week here on Capitol Hill. that's the real guy he is. There's no sort of airs about him, even though he went to, you know, Columbia for college and Harvard for law school and Oxford, got his PhD. There's no airs about the guy. He's a very down-to-earth, normal guy, the kind of guy you can get a beer with.
You know, Democrats are probably don't have much of a chance to block him, although it's still unknown whether or not they'll actually try to do that. I know they're still angered over Republicans' refusal to even give President Obama's pick a hearing. This was technically, the vacancy became available during President Obama's term. They're pretty bitter over that. Do you think they're going to make it even harder on this judge? And do you think that that will make any difference ultimately? And how will he handle it, knowing him?
Well, look, I think he's a very even-keel kind of guy. I think he really has a healthy respect for the Senate's process. And I think he realizes that, you know, that the Senate has an important role to play here and has to confirm him, has to provide advice and consent, at least, to his nomination. And he will do his best to answer the questions put to him. I think that he will, you know, give honest, upfront answers consistent with the traditions of the judges that have been nominated and have come before him. No merit to them.
So I understand you're actually going to be testifying on Judge Gorsuch's behalf. Where and when and why?
So Thursday of the hearing, they're going to have outside witnesses come and testify, some about the judge, some about his jurisprudence and the like, law professors, other judges that have worked with him, people from the think tank community, and both sides are going to have their witnesses. We're going to have a few law clerks, including me, testify about the judge and our time working with him and our knowledge of him. And talk about, you know, his capabilities and skills and who he's to work, what he'd like to work for. And so that'll be part of the process. It's historically been part of the process to have outside witnesses, including former law clerks.
Do you think Judge Gorsuch, if it came to be that a case came to the Supreme Court regarding the president's and some of the many legal issues that he's facing, whether it be ethics or Russia or whatever, do you think that this judge could be able to be impartial?
Absolutely. And let me tell you how I know that. When I served with Judge Gorsuch in his first 4 months as a law clerk to him when he first joined the bench, you know, he had just left the Justice Department. And so he was coming out of a government job. And so you might expect that he might have a bias in favor of the government or want to decide cases in the government's favor or the like. And actually, as it turns out, we spent a lot of time thinking about his ethical obligations and his need to recuse from most government cases. I mean, a lot of other cases. And in fact, he went well beyond what the law required when it came to recusals in order to ensure that he did the right thing. And then even beyond that, when he was in the courtroom and he took on that responsibility of being a judge, you could see that his goal was to look at the law specifically, look at the facts of the case and apply the law to the facts and not try to apply his own personal leanings, political leanings. None of that, all that stuff went away when he became a judge. So it was really neat to watch him go through that transformation. And I think there's no doubt in my mind that Neil Gorsuch, Judge Neil Gorsuch, who's a judge's judge, you know, will be just that kind of Supreme Court justice if he's lucky enough to be confirmed, that he will absolutely be independent of this president and, frankly, any other president to come.
Jamil Jaffer currently serves as an adjunct professor, National Security Institute founder, and director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at George Mason University School of Law. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
New observations by an international team of astronomers show that huge galaxies created some 10 billion years ago during a peak in galaxy formation were comprised of mostly baryonic or normal matter and very little of the mysterious dark matter that tends to dominate much younger galaxies. The astronomers led by Germany's Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics made their findings after measuring the rotation of six massive and distant star-forming galaxies. Using the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope, the group of scientists said they found that the outer regions of these old galaxies rotated much slower than areas closer to their cores. That's different than much younger spiral galaxies. The astronomers think this difference suggests that there is less dark matter present in the ancient galaxies than had been expected. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. It is time now, unfortunately, for some sad news from our music department.
And I shall do for you first a song that I first recorded. It was a fairly nice hit, and it went quite high in the American charts. The title of it is Maybelline. Oh, Maybelline, it ain't to be true.
Edward Anderson Berry in the U.S. city of St. Louis, Missouri, in 1926. Chuck Berry went on to pioneer a musical form that has become synonymous with American music. And over the weekend, he died in St. Charles, Missouri, at the age of 9. One of Berry's big hits, but he only had one number one hit, and that was My Ding-a-ling. We decided not to give you a clip of that song because it's somewhat double meaning, so you should go online to check it out. Refined and developed rhythm and blues into the major elements that became rock and roll and makes that genre distinctive. Berry's songs always featured his amazing showmanship and his mastery on guitar.
Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready? Are you ready for the guitar king of rock and roll, Chuck Berry? Against modern jazz, unless they try to play a new darn band and change the beauty of the melody and make it sound like a symphony. That's why I go for this rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it, got a backbeat, you can do it. Any old time you use it.
Chuck Berry was a major influence on many of the rock music performers who came after him, and many of them ended up playing backup for him on stage. Nils Lofgren, a guitarist of renown who is a solo artist and once played for Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, tells the story of backing up Berry one night and Berry famously not communicating with his backup players, who were all playing in different keys.
And at the height of it, when everyone, no one has an idea how to fix this, Chuck looks at us all and starts looking at us, duck walking off the stage, away from us. He leaves the stage, leaves us all out there playing in six different keys with no band leader, gets in a car and drives away. Now, if that's not rock and roll, I mean, and I love Chuck Berry, but man, you know, it's funny, all these years and stories of, did you ever back up Chuck? No. Well, I got my chance. And man, it was everything that was promised and more.
Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, well, back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood. Well, lived a country boy named Johnny B. Good, who never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could play a guitar just like ringing a bell.
Of Chuck Berry's many big hits, Johnny B. Good has to be one among everyone's favorites. I was looking on my download list. I have about 12 versions of Johnny B. Good. Can you believe it? Live studio versions, every one of them different, every one of them fantastic. Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. World news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now let's move on to that genius, more of that genius, many of us know as Chuck Berry.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As has been the case in previous years, human rights conditions in Zimbabwe remain deeply troubling, according to the recently issued State Department country reports on human rights practices. In 2016, the government of President Robert Mugabe continued to violate human rights, disregarding the protections enumerated in the country's 2013 constitution. The most important human rights problems remain the government's targeting members of non-ZANU-PF parties and civil society activists for abduction, arrest, torture, abuse, and harassment, partisan application of the rule of law by security forces and the judiciary, and restrictions on civil liberties, including freedoms of expression and assembly. In 2016, the government intensified its repression of peaceful protesters. Police abuse increased, and security forces used excessive force to crush dissent. Human rights defenders, civil society activists, journalists, and government opponents were harassed, threatened, or faced arbitrary arrest by security forces. The government restricted freedom of the press. Although citizens have the constitutional right to choose their own government in free and fair elections, this right was restricted. Corruption at all levels of government was rampant in Zimbabwe. Despite the fact that the government took some limited steps to punish security sector officials and ZANU-PF supporters who committed violations, impunity for past politically motivated violence was a problem. The government, for example, failed to provide any updates on the 2015 disappearance of activist Etai Zamara. Rape, domestic violence, and discrimination against women remain widespread problems, despite the fact that last January, Zimbabwe's constitutional court declared child marriage to be unconstitutional and set 18 as the minimum marriage age. The government has yet to amend or repeal all existing marriage laws that still allow child marriage. On the other side of that spectrum, widows were forced from their marital homes by relatives and their property confiscated with little recourse to the formal justice system. The State Department human rights reports are not meant to point fingers or judge the actions of sovereign nations, nor are these U.S. policy documents. The reports do not draw legal conclusions. Promoting human rights and democratic governance is a core element of U.S. foreign policy, said Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Standing up for human rights and democracy is not just a moral imperative, but it is in the best interests of the United States in making the world more stable and secure.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.